Hello again, and welcome to the Planet Beyond podcast, brought to you by Fugro, the leading partner in delivering geodata from the greatest subsea depths right to outer space, and hosted by me, John Baston Pitt. Today, we have the privilege of exploring the groundbreaking work of the Square Kilometer Array Observatory. That's SKAO, and the incredible journey of one of its key figures, Rosie Bolton. The SKAO, a monumental international collaboration involving 16 countries, is poised to revolutionize our understanding of the universe with its state-of-the-art telescopes spanning two continents. From the outback of Western Australia to the plains of South Africa, the SKAO's telescopes are gearing up to unveil cosmic mysteries that have long eluded us. But behind the awe-inspiring telescopes lies a complex web of data processing, management, and distribution, all orchestrated by experts like Rosie. As the head of the SKAO's Data Operations Group, Rosie plays a pivotal role in translating raw astronomical data into groundbreaking discoveries. Rosie, welcome to Planet Beyond. Could you start by giving us some kind of background on what the SKAO is and why it was set up?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, John. Thanks for having me. The SKAO Observatory is an enormous global scale project to build the next generation of radio telescopes to really push forward our scientific understanding of the universe, with a focus on targeting the early universe, but really being able to see all the way through as the universe has evolved. It is an international collaboration with 16 participating countries, all getting involved and financially supporting, an enormous project which is under construction now, to build this one observatory with two telescope locations.
Where are these going to be based, Rosie?
So we're going to have big telescope arrays in South Africa and in Australia, and a headquarters in the UK at Jodrell Bank in Cheshire. We're building the largest two radio telescope arrays on the planet. One of them, which we call SKA Low, will be in Western Australia, and that one corresponds to 131,072 Christmas tree-shaped antennas, which are designed to pick up the low radio frequencies. And then we'll have another one in South Africa, which we call SKA Mid, which will consist of 197 parabolic dishes, like big radio dishes, 15 meters across.
Those are both immense engineering projects, but what will we learn from them?
And yeah, by building this enormous observatory, these two great arrays, with the computers at the afterwards to process the data, we will be able to revolutionize our understanding of the universe, and that's the fundamental goal, to look further, to look deeper and see more, delivering astronomy data to our users.
I want to ask you about the international collaboration to make this possible, but before I dive into that area, I'd just like to ask you, isn't this everybody's dream to be involved in something like this?
I would hope that it would be. I mean, I've been excited by astronomy and science since I was a young child. Absolutely. It's a dream come true to have this now under construction. It has been discussed genuinely for decades. The early concepts of trying to build a radio telescope sensitive enough to see the very first galaxies starting has been discussed for 30 years or so, but because of the way the telescopes work, which we'll probably come into soon, they require an enormous amount of computing to translate the signals we get into usable data products. And so I really think that it is this epoch we're in now where we're computationally competent. You know, if you think about the changes that have happened in our computing power since the 1960s, compare them to now, you know, we've gone through so many generations of improvements in computing that now is the epoch where we are for the first time able to seriously consider doing this.
And that's because of the computational power available to use those data. But another factor has been the international collaboration needed.
Yeah, you're quite right. So there's huge benefits to the way we're doing things now. And one of the driving forces for why we have to have such a big collaboration is that we need to build an enormous telescope to see as far into the universe as we want to see. And that means that we're talking about a total budget of around 2 billion euros to construct and operate these machines for the first decade.
Brilliant. Well, let's get down onto the ground. How did you decide on the locations of these two telescopes?
Yeah, certainly. So, I mean, firstly, it's perhaps worth trying to explain why we have two rather than just one. So we have two separate arrays of antennas, and the SKA Low antennas in Australia look like 131,000 Christmas tree shaped antennas spread across the land there. When we decide where to build the SKA arrays, we need to consider the environment in which those arrays are going to sit. So we want to be able to detect radio waves coming in from the outer universe that are very, very faint signals. If we have people on their mobile phones, people driving cars with spark plugs, you know, anything that's producing an electrical signal nearby can generate radio waves. So we're really sensitive to interference from, you know, humankind moving around. So we've identified some very good sparsely populated sites in semi-arid regions. And we're very lucky that the sites are now nationally protected radio quiet zones in both South Africa and Australia. So we have commitments from those host countries to protect the radio environment that we're sighting our telescopes in, which is really good.
It must have been very complex to find sites that met your needs.
That site selection process was a very long process. Multiple different countries were considered. You know, many countries put forward options for where they might propose to host an SKA antenna. But the successful sites were chosen because of their radio quiet zones and the way that their geography matches what we need. So we have to consider the topology of the land. You know, it can't be too mountainous. It has to be quite level and flat for us to build our arrays on. And we need to consider the amount of interference from people. And we need to consider the atmospheric weather to a degree as well. And how windy it is. You know, if it's windy and there's heavy rain often, this is just bad for operating a large infrastructure.
So you were able to find areas with the right landscape and where governments could commit to maintain radio silence. How are you getting on with building the telescopes?
So where we are now in construction is that, you know, for a long time we've been designing the arrays, thinking about how you would build such things, working out how much it costs to do this, which is very important because it affects how much you can build. So there's a bit of a back and forth between the cost and the design. We've settled on the design of our first SKA, you know, release now, and we have a plan for how to get there. And that has meant that we've been able to get the financial input from our partners and then use it to, you know, place contracts with suppliers to start building stuff. So it's very exciting. We now have the first real antennas on the sites in the two locations.
Yes, very exciting. And what a commitment from stakeholders involved So tell us about site development and how that's looking.
So we've had the first antennas deployed in Australia. In March, we had teams out there, you know, the first field technicians out there, you know, building this, the first station of antennas. And that's just the start of 131, you know, times setting up these antennas, 131,000 times setting up these antennas, right? So they're starting to learn how to do it and streamlining their processes. And also we've had the first dish arrive in South Africa that's come by ship from China. And it's now being assembled, you know, as we speak, it's being assembled in South Africa. So it's really, really an exciting time now.
That does sound like hard work, but yes, exciting work. Let's dive into the details a little bit more. How do these telescopes actually work? What is the data you're collecting, and how do you then go on to interpret that data?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it's a fairly long story, but let's first just think about what are the signals we're receiving? So the signals we're receiving are radio waves. In our day-to-day lives, we probably think about radio waves as being human-generated, but actually they are naturally occurring. So the radio wave is just part of the electromagnetic spectrum. It's basically a very low energy form of light. You'd be familiar with this if you know, we know that the sun glows very brightly in the optical light. We see it with our eyes, but we can also feel the heat from the sun on the back of our hand. You feel that infrared radiation coming from the sun. So the sun as a star is emitting across a broad range of wavelengths. It's focusing the emission in the optical range, but it actually does emit radio signals too. So it's one of the strongest radio sources in the sky.
With all those sources, how do you pick out the signals that you're interested in?
You don't want to have that in your radio data particularly, but that's okay. You just don't look at it. But the sun is the star. There are stars everywhere. So we know that there are sources of radio light in every star, but also in galaxies as well. Particularly from our science perspective, one of the key ways radio waves are generated is by electrons spiraling around in magnetic fields. You have this combination of an electron and a magnetic field. As it gets spiraled round on its path, it emits radio frequency waves quite often. And that is a way for us to trace, you know, that type of emission.
What other radio wave emitters are there?
We also, really importantly, have radio waves that are generated by hydrogen. So hydrogen gas the atoms in hydrogen have a particular radio frequency that they will emit. One tiny spectral line, we call it. So, you know, a single colour of light, but it's radio, one single radio wavelength that they will emit, to do with highly complex physics, but to do with a transition within the atom itself. So a quantum mechanical transition happens within the atom, and that releases a photon of radio light. So it's fine detail. The result of it is that we are able to detect hydrogen gas in the universe, and that is a key principle for SKA. That's one part of the puzzle.
So that's what you're collecting, but how are you collecting it?
Then you have to think about how we collect those radio signals. Well, many of you, many of your listeners, many of us know that we're used to seeing TV aerials on our houses. It's probably the easiest analogy. So an old-fashioned Yagi TV antenna, you know, has got a bunch of metal strips. Those metal strips have currents get induced in them when a radio wave passes across them. So that means that a radio wave touching that antenna makes a small current flow within the metal. Now, we're basically doing the same thing, but we are closer to a DAB radio. So we are looking to digitize the signal as it comes in and then use our computing systems to analyze it as we go forward.
I'm curious, Rosie, how many antenna are we talking about? And why are they called Christmas trees?
But fundamentally, we're building 131,000 Christmas tree-shaped antennas in Australia to pick up these radio wave signals across a range of different wavelengths. So that's why we have a Christmas tree shape, because the longer wavelengths needs to be picked up by lower down the Christmas tree, and the shorter wavelengths, the higher frequencies, are coming from nearer the top of the Christmas tree. We pass those signals into an amplifier and a digitizer, and then we have them in noughts and ones, and they're kind of safe then, if you like, because then we're able to play with them in the digital way that we're all used to working with now.
So compared to the old-fashioned aerial that we used to have on the top of all of our houses, one aerial, you need 130,000 of them. I guess because the signal is something like 130,000 times weaker?
Actually, I wouldn't be able to guess the number. I assume very much fainter even than that. But yes, we need to have the number of antennas that we're targeting, because the signals we're trying to detect are from right at the early universe.
So just how far back are we looking? And what does it take to see back in time like that?
So there's a really interesting concept. If you've ever thought about how we look into space, you'll have worked it out already. But, you know, if you look at an object in space, which is one light year away, the signal that you're seeing left a year ago, right? So turn that around. If you want to look at objects in the universe which are 13 billion years old, so when the universe was 13 billion years younger than it is now, you have to be able to look 13 billion light years away from where we are on Earth. So the further back in time we want to explore the universe, the further away we have to be able to detect signals from. And that means that they will be fainter because they're further away.
That's going to require complicated data transportation and distribution from the telescopes to supercomputers. Can you elaborate on the challenges and innovations in this aspect of SKAO's operation?
Yeah, you're right. So the data transfer, the data management within the observatory, and then getting the data out to the users is a really big challenge for SKA, and an exciting, you know, area to be involved in. So the within the observatory, so we have to get the signals, once they're digitized, we have to get them from the antennas to a central processing facility at each location. Those are actually going to be in Perth and in Cape Town. So they'll be within, you know, sort of city, comfortable city locations where you can have a comfortable environment for a supercomputer to sit, basically.
And is this where data will be combined?
In those locations, that's when we start to really combine the signals from the different antennas in a way that gives us some scientific output. And then we have a supercomputer at each site that will turn those mixed signals, visibility signals, or, you know, fairly simple stream signals that, you know, continuously being generated, gather them up, maybe 8 hours worth at a time or whatever a user needs. So gather them up together and then build a single integration's worth of output. It's an image, but it's a three-dimensional image because it can contain many different radio colours as well, so we can see different frequencies at the same time.
That's an interesting concept. How will you use the data? And can you give us an idea of scale here?
And so we basically build an image cube of the region that a user wanted to look at. And that requires a significant supercomputer to do that. But then once you've done that, we're talking about, you know, data rates into that computing facility of around about 8 terabits per second. So really enormous data rates coming in. And then the data products that we make can be, we think, you know, 500 terabytes in size per data product. In theory, even a petabyte would be possible for a cube, which is immense. These are enormous data rates. We can't do those enormous products very often because we wouldn't be able to store it anywhere in the world. If we generated data too fast, we wouldn't be able to get it out of the sites.
Those are some huge numbers. Remind us what a petabyte is, please.
When I think about the size of data, and we've noticed this a lot, it's really easy to get confused by three orders of magnitude. Like mixing up your petabytes and your terabytes and your gigabytes is so easily done. It's really hard to imagine. So a pretty high-end desktop SSD drive at the moment is about 30 terabytes. You can buy a 30 terabyte SSD drive, and it's a kind of box that would sit on your desk. We're talking about 30 of those a day from each of the sites. So they'd be sizable, but you know, you could fit them in the back of your car probably. But then every day, there's 365 days a year, and this observatory is going to last for 50 years. So we're talking about an archive of data products, which will become exabyte scale within a few years, and then eventually, you know, grow even beyond that. So that's very, very expensive to manage, to think about what we do. We're going to have to very carefully work out how to optimize which products go where, which ones we keep for a long time, which ones we don't keep forever, which ones we put into the deep freeze. You know, you can store things relatively cheaply if you use tape technology, for example, but that's the equivalent of putting them in the chest freezer in your garage underneath the frozen peas. Like, they're very hard to get to if you put them in these cheaper technologies.
You're going to have to think twice about how many backups you make.
Yeah. we already are thinking about how we back up the data, how many times. We want to have a full replica management system where we know exactly how many backups there are of each product and why each backup is justified.
Correct me, but I can't help feeling slightly nervous when I listen to you talk about all the resources and the inputs going in to start building these models. Is it not possible, given you've not got to the end of the journey yet, that there's something that's been misthought of or not thought through correctly, and the data quality isn't going to be sufficient?
So this is a very interesting question. What we're trying to do with SKA has not been done before, right? We want to be able to go deeper than we've ever been before into the universe. We want to see more. I think it is inevitable that that won't be plain sailing in terms of calibrating the science, but it doesn't come as one step. So one of the key experiments that we'd like to do with SKA is to try and detect the signal from the epoch of reionization. I'll talk about that, and I think it might explain how we'll do it.
I think you might need to take us through that step by step.
So that epoch of reionization was this period when the universe was between 200 and 400 million years old, when the first stars started burning. As those first stars started burning, they started to ionize the hydrogen. So they start to destroy the neutral hydrogen because the ultraviolet radiation from those stars basically ionized the hydrogen atoms. As I said before, SKA will be able to detect hydrogen gas. So if it can detect hydrogen gas, it can also detect where there are gaps in the hydrogen gas. And that's the epoch of reionization signal we're trying to find. We want to see evidence of these first stars burning holes in the hydrogen as they switch on.
So how are you planning to do that?
To do that, we think that we will need to be doing an experiment where we stare at the same piece of sky for hundreds or even a thousand hours. So we will be looking at the same patch of sky again and again and again with the low frequency antennas to try and build up a map or build up data from that sky, which gets us enough sensitivity to see the hydrogen and the pockets in the hydrogen. So that doesn't happen overnight, of course. It will actually take several years to achieve this goal, even once SKA is built. And as we do it, we will be able to analyze the data products as we go. So you start off, you might do a 1 hour test or a 10 hour test for a sort of science verification and commissioning purposes. And then once that's been verified, that you know that your pipelines are good, you know, your data processing is correct and you think it's looking like it's still improving, then you do the next 10 times as much. So you might do 10 hours, then you might do 100 hours.
This is incredible, Rosie. So what if the opposite happens? What happens to those signals that you can't clean up?
Now, what can happen is that you discover a systematic noise signal which doesn't do this reduction. So it should be, if you look at something for four times as long, the noise should halve. It should be a square or square root relationship between the two. So you can quite quickly learn if that's not happening, and then you have to then try and figure out if there is a systematic error that you can understand. How do you take it out? That's not necessarily easy, but as we go along, we'll do it. The step change comes from how we're building it out, but we're still, as we build the SKA over the next 5 years or so, we have the ability to learn as we go. We have, a 1% array, we have a 10% array, we have a 50% array. You know, because it's an interferometer, because we have many antennas, we can check the whole system works, even in its smaller version. So I'm hoping that gives us an understanding of what we're doing.
You've described the most ambitious, enormous investment in time, money, and energy. What's close to my heart, close to the message of this podcast, is openness in terms of data. Tell us, is this data going to be available to the many or the few? What is the process going to be for making the data and the telescopes themselves accessible to researchers?
Yeah, so this is a really good point and an important aspect of SKA Observatory. So the observatory itself will be run by having scientists apply for time on the telescope. And they do that by basically dreaming up the science they want to do, working out what they need the SKA to do for them to deliver the science data products that they need, and then write a justification of why their science is exciting, how they can do it technically, and how much data it ends up being, how many hours they think they need to have on the telescope. That then gets peer reviewed. And also that will be balanced against the national membership of the SKA Observatory. So, for example, if a country was a 10% member of SKA, if they basically were paying 10% of the costs for SKA, they should be expecting that 10% of the resources of SKA would be being used to do the science of their national scientists. It's actually quite difficult to calculate because most of the science teams will be international. Very few science teams are local these days. You want expertise from across the astronomy group.
And what happens if your country is not a member of the SKA?
But even beyond that, there will be a fraction of time for SKA that will be open to non-member countries too. So a scientist in a country that's not a member will still be able to apply for SKA time. When they do that, though, successful proposals will be observed, the data products will be made, and then they will be made available to users. And we also imagine having some services which are available to support citizen science and really generally public access, because it is really good fun to be able to explore real science output from observatories. I know I do it. I'm perhaps not a normal person in this regard, but I do like going to see what other observatories have looked at. And citizen science is a really valuable input into how telescopes do end up, contributing, or how we learn more about the universe.
And there are some good examples of how citizen science can contribute to projects like these, aren't there?
Yes, there are. And in general, just beyond just pure citizen science, making sure that your legacy data products are available for reuse, even by expert astronomers, can deliver an enormous amount of value. Hubble Space Telescope has an archive which, you know, even whilst it was, you know, under normal operations as a space telescope, the archive data was delivering as much, if not more, science impact than the newly generated data as well. And for example, discovery of fast radio bursts came out of archival data. And you'll probably be aware, or your listeners will be aware, of citizen science projects where, you know, genuinely living room astronomers who are not professional astronomers, you know, discover something in an optical catalogue that no one ever thought about before, because no human eye with a human brain connected ever actually looked and thought, ooh, that looks funny, like this looks weird. And that's what gives us the edge.
You've just touched upon a theme that has been coming through in our podcasts a lot. Collaboration and making data accessible really does accelerate discovery and understanding.
There's actually some fun things to do with the interplay between citizen science and artificial intelligence, which will be really interesting to see going forward. You can use citizen science, you can use those citizens to train artificial intelligence, you know, to become more intelligent. Otherwise, it doesn't know how to detect what's unusual. You have to actually have some humans spotting what do we count as weird in order to move forward.
How amazing. Now, let's just get imaginative for a second. Let's get creative. What are some of the anticipated discoveries or scientific breakthroughs that the SKA aims to achieve?
Yeah, so I'll be biased, I think, and I'll come back to probably my favourite, you know, target for the SKA, which is to be able to discover this epoch of reionization, you know, looking back to the period in the universe where it was only, you know, 300 million years old, and those first stars and galaxies were switching on and starting to shine their light. That's so exciting. That's really hard, of course. As I mentioned, the universe now is 13.8 billion years old. So if you want to look back all that way, you've got 13.5 billion years worth of universe in between you and that signal that you want. Right, now that is a pain, actually. It's genuinely an issue. We call it, you know, the foreground. If you're doing the epoch of reionization experiment, the EOR, if you're trying to get to that signal, all of that universe in front is kind of a mess. This, like, the noise in your signal. But that's actually not the right way to look at it, because someone's noise is someone else's science. All of that universe is nearer to us than the epoch of reionization signal, and, you know, bits of it will be a lot brighter. So the SKA will be able to see everything along the way, kind of whether we like it or not. And so because we're going to be an open observatory, we'll be able to do all kinds of science, you know, from all epochs in the universe's history as we move forward. So I love the epoch of reionization. I think if we can discover that signal, if it can help us understand the cosmology of the early universe, that will be amazing. That's the equivalent of discovering the Higgs boson by CERN. You know, this is really the thing. But there's so much other science we can do, which is, you know, equally impactful along the way.
Tell us more about those other areas of exploration then.
Particularly because SKA's frequency response and fidelity, our ability to determine the colour of the radio light so well, will allow us to measure the redshift of the hydrogen. The hydrogen signal that is in radio is a single colour of radio light. So that means that we can use the redshift concept whereby The further away objects, because the universe is expanding, the further away they are, the faster they're moving away from us, the more redshifted that radio signal becomes. So it gets shifted to a lower frequency. So basically, by looking at the frequency of the hydrogen line, we can determine how far away an object is. So we can build up a three-dimensional map of the universe if we can look at the hydrogen. So there's been talk in the past, and I hope we can achieve something close to this, of doing a 1 billion galaxy survey in 3D with SKA. So we're trying to work out, you know, from a significant chunk of the universe, what the 3D matrix of galaxy placement looks like. So where do these objects sit on the cosmic web, you know, the bath sponge between, you know, so the universe is full of gaps, but the galaxies sit on this kind of bath sponge kind of matrix. We can detect these galaxies in the matrix, and we'll be able to compare it with simulations, which will help us understand, did we guess the right parameters for the simulation? Are our cosmological predictions correct? So I love the idea that we can detect these three-dimensional maps of the universe and try and plot the universe's evolution, you know, as it has gone. It's brilliant. And of course, all of this stuff will come into a science archive where we will then have, you know, reuse many times of the data to do different science. Someone looks at it in a different way, they look in a different place, they see some new science and can publish that once the data is public. So yeah, I'm a fan of all of the science of SKA, but I love the hydrogen through the ages. I think it's going to be great.
It's going to be great. Well, just to round off, let's come back to the work and talk about a few practicalities. Can you give us a sense of the timeline? When do you expect the telescopes and the data centres to be up and running?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, the telescopes are under construction now. It's an ambitious schedule, but we are hoping that we'll be able to do the first scientific verification in just a couple of years. So in 2026, we should be looking at being able to do verification. So that means verifying the telescope is behaving well. And you do that by looking at an object you already know. So you look at a familiar radio object and you say, does my telescope give a picture of it that, you know, matches what our current understanding is? And that helps you debug the antennas, helps you work out what your calibration effects are, for example. Gives you confidence that you're building the array correctly. And then we have a series of incremental releases of the arrays as they grow. So they grow bit by bit. By 2028, we'll be really doing cutting edge, open science, you know, open for proposals from new users. And then, yeah, fully operational, bedded down, hopefully understanding our system well, you know, early into the next decade. And then we've got another 40 years worth of exciting science ahead of us.
Wow. Thank you so much for joining us today, Rosie. This is an incredible feat of engineering and collaboration, from the intricate construction of the telescopes across two continents to the groundbreaking data processing methods. It's clear that the SKAO represents the pinnacle of international collaboration and scientific innovation. Rose's insights into the challenges and potential of managing vast amounts of astronomical data underscore the transferable and transformative impact that projects like SKAO can have, not just on our understanding of the cosmos, but on society as a whole. The promise of discovering new phenomena, such as Rose's favourite, the epoch of reionization, reminds us of the endless frontier that is space science and the boundless opportunities it presents for human discovery. If you enjoyed listening to this episode, leave a rating in the podcast app you're listening on and help us reach a wider audience by sharing this episode with your network, your family and friends. Until next time, be safe, be remarkable, be the difference. Thank you very much.
Sorry, I have a cat outside on my office and I will go and put him away downstairs. Otherwise, you'll have scratching at the door. Sorry.
What's the cat's name?
That one's Leo.
Leo. Oh, there's a...
So I have Leo and Cassiopeia. So they are named after constellations, which is pretty cute.
Oh, wow.
But we didn't name them ourselves. They came from a rescue home and they were already named with constellations. We were like, we're having them.
Wow. Now, there's something special in that, isn't there?
Yeah, it's nice.
They were destined for you, Rosie.
Yeah, they knew they were heading our way. Okay, do you want to repeat the last question? Or, talk us through...